with Scott Allen.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in this beautiful world. I am your host, Scott J. Allen, and this is Phronesis, Practical Wisdom for Leaders. Now, I am a professor of management at John Carroll University in Cleveland, Ohio, USA. In addition, I'm a husband and father of three teens. Now, this is a family endeavor. Will played the intro, Kate voiced the intro, and who knows, you may hear from Emily a little later. I'm also an author, entrepreneur, speaker, and co-founder of the Collegiate Leadership Competition. I love to travel, explore new places with family, and learn from others. Phronesis offers a smart, fast-paced discussion about all things leadership and followership, if we're honest. My guests are scholars and practitioners, and we cover relevant topics and incorporate practical tips designed to help you make a difference in how you lead and live. I am proud to share a few updates. According to Listen Notes, Phronesis is listed as among the top 3% of podcasts in the world because of you. So thank you. In addition, the podcast has two sponsors. First, Phronesis is the official podcast of the International Leadership Association, an association that is near and dear to my heart. ILA brings together leaders and those who teach, study, and develop leadership, advancing leadership knowledge and practice for a better world. Learn more at ila-net.org. My second sponsor is the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. At Bowler, we offer several advanced degrees and MBAs, and I'm confident that there's one that will fit your location, interests, and timeline. In fact, our online MBA is ranked as the number one in Ohio and number nine in the United States. We offer international study tours, a contemporary and forward-looking curriculum, and access to senior leaders and flagship organizations. Learn more at business.jcu.edu. You can find links to both sponsors in the show notes. Now, if you like what we're up to, please hit subscribe so you can stay current as we release new episodes each week. You can also share what we're up to with others, friends, colleagues, leaders, teams, students, and others you think will benefit. And now, today's show. Okay, everybody, welcome to the Phronesis Podcast. Thank you so much for checking in wherever you are in the world. Today, I have Dr. Steve Kempster, Emeritus Professor of Leadership Learning and Development at Lancaster University Management School, and is an associative partner of the Regenerative Alliance. He has published broadly on leadership learning, leadership of purpose, and responsible leadership with 5 books and many articles and chapters. Steve leads the Good Dividends Project, formed from an interdisciplinary group of academics drawn from 5 universities in Europe and Australasia, with the objective of enabling business leaders to develop their business models towards becoming regenerative and realizing good growth. His latest book is Good Dividends, Responsible Leadership of Business Purpose. Recently, Steve has been the director of the Lancaster University Made Smarter and Evolve Digital Programs, linking digitization with regenerative outcomes, funded by the UK government. He is currently co-director of the Lancaster University Good Growth Program, focused on reframing growth towards regenerative outcomes and business towards a well-being economy. Sir, always a pleasure to be with you. So very thankful for the opportunity to engage in our second. You were an early guest. You were one of the first few brave souls to join me on Phronesis. And you tell a funny story about that. Why don't you share that with listeners?
Well, I just remember, because it was so early on in lockdown, and I think I just had lunch. So it was, 2 o'clock here, UK. And I don't think I was really taking it very seriously because I know you from the past. And I thought, it's just going to be a couple of people. It's not going to last long, this podcast thing. And I was just chatting away as if it was me and you in a pub having a laugh. And I think I went on far too long. I think I was close to the hour mark. It must have been some morning. But this time, much more serious, much more professional, focused on what you asked.
Well, you know, one thing I love about our friendship is the laughter. And one thing I love about our friendship is your curiosity in this space. And you always stretch my thinking. And so I'm excited today. And I know listeners will have their thinking stretched as well. Let's start off with some kind of definitions. I mean, I was using some words in your bio, good dividends or regenerative. Maybe take listeners through some of the basics, and then let's talk about your work and how you're seeing this concept of leadership kind of unfold.
Yeah. It was pretty heavy lexicon that you went through, so my apologies.
You made me say words like Australasia and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Could you put a pin on the map? Would you know where it is? Anyway, so regenerative, I think that's the big word, and I think it needs to become a much, much bigger word in people's everyday conversations, and we'll probably get into that to an extent. So we often think of sustainability as the goal, and in many ways, it's a good, laudable thing to be pursuing, but it sort of means, in practical terms, limiting the amount of harm we do. And can we get to no harm through the activities of what we're about? The idea of regenerative is to go beyond that, to go beyond restorative. So regenerative, it draws from a biological root. So you'd have an ecology to which species are interconnecting with plants, and you create this very complex web, an ecosystem that enables all to flourish. But in that flourishing, things get born, things grow well, things pass away, but it's all part of that same ecosystem. In a sense, their death enriches the future opportunities for others. So instead of thinking it will always get better, and we may touch on this when we get onto good growth, regenerative is basically a flourishing dynamic in which, if you take an example of a business, because that business exists, it is embedded in an ecosystem that it is enriching all those it interconnects with. So as a consequence of it doing well, so that ecosystem must do well. It is not a question of if that business does well, others must suffer. It's not a zero-sum game. It's embedded in its place, in its community, in its environment. Its flourishing means others flourish with it. But it's a much more complicated dynamic because eventually it may well move on, pass, change in ways, but it releases people, resources that are enhanced for other places to make good impact. So regenerative is a really important word. So if you imagine you end up with a regenerative economy or you end up with a regenerative business sectors, you're getting caught up in a really interesting dynamic of a world where others are engaging and benefiting. It's a bit like enlightened self-interest. Because I'm investing in others, so it reciprocates and comes back. And that's where the good dividends argument started flourishing. So the idea of good dividends, and it was a deliberate word, and it causes problems, well, it's caused me problems, A, trying to explain dividends, because everybody thinks finance, as soon as you say dividends, particularly shares, what dividends are you getting from your shares, would be a normal conversation. But the way we develop the idea of dividends is it's a return, it's a benefit. So let's say, for example, investing in your employees. So remember that regenerative ecosystem I was talking about. If you engage and invest in people, whether that's through appropriate reward, remuneration, whether that's through the development of their skills, whether that's through making sure the work that's done is meaningful, if you imagine that, you are investing as a leader in to try and create the conditions in which people give off their best. There's nothing new here, Scott. So if we invest in employees, human capital, what is the return? What is the dividend from that appropriate investment in people? Well, what we overwhelmingly know from others' research is where employee engagement is very high through that investment. Productivity's up, quality's up, customer service is up, innovation's up. So you get this flow through. So then if you imagine the good dividends is a set of these capitals, like human resource capital, people, then you've got operational capital, innovative capital, reputational capital, marketing orientation, financial capital, of course, but your sixth one is planet, community. So imagine a business that invests in its community or invests to enhance its local environment. What is the return to the business from that investment? So this isn't philanthropy. This is actually saying we wish to make a strategic development in our neighborhood, maybe with a particular charity, that because of our engagement with them, we will track that investment as we would in any other way to see what are the benefits that flow so we can sustain that partnership, grow that partnership, make it regenerative. Both of us are working together, getting better and better in what we do. And as a consequence, we see the dividends flow into the whole business system. So people feel more engaged. It's meaningful what we're doing. We've explicitly developed this partnership with maybe a particular charity or charities. We can see that our reputation is enriched because of this authentic nature that what we're investing in this partnership matters to us, and that flows. So now we've got meaningful work, employee engagement, we've got enhanced reputation, and you can then see how that then flows around these capitals. So hence the idea of dividends. Now, the word good, there's a risk here, Scott. I'm turning into one of my lectures to undergrad and postgrad students, here, and I'm going on and on.
You're all good.
So the word good, I think the word good is wonderful. If you're still listening and everybody else is still listening, the idea of a good person, Scott, if you just think for a second, someone you know in your life who's a deeply good person, can you, I'm going to put you on the spot, Scott,
sure.
What characteristics would you see of that good person?
Well, they are ethical. They follow through. They're interested in others. It's not all just about them, but they are other-oriented at times. They are benefiting the space around them and creating a space for others to thrive as well. I just thought of my wife. Yeah. Describes Jess.
Yeah. And in many ways, I don't want to go off into a tangent, part of the good dividends is rooted in an ethical, philosophical base around virtue ethics. And so what you're describing are the virtue practices of a very good person. And so if you then imagine you go from good person to a good business, and those characteristics then flow through how they do their dealings. So the idea, in case anybody thought, so you do some nice things with some charity in order to make your reputation a bit better. That sounds a bit like virtue signaling or greenwashing or some dynamic like that.
Yep, yep.
Well, is it what you are about? Is it authentic? Is this strategic, this investment in this charity? Is it part of your business plan? Is it part of what you speak to your employees about and pursue it as opposed to a quick one in, one out, and move on to another charity? We didn't get much dividend from that. So it's that sense of how the good fits to those dividends as opposed to just the exploitation of dividends. It's the sense of the business and what it's about.
Well, I have a word that's come to mind. It just design. It seems to me that this requires design, forethought, intentionality.
So you very kindly in the bio that you read through said latest book is The Good Dividends, and it is. That was 2019 it came out. And I'm now working on a book with three others, and it's called Good Growth. So I'm nudging us here to get into that good growth conversation. Oh, here's a fascinating thing. You imagine this, Scott. There's four of us. There's myself and Stuart Barnes, Dr. Stuart Barnes, and we're going to write the text. We've then got a graphic designer who's co-author, and then we've got a digital software writer.
Okay.
Who's going to create a companion website that has a series of tools. And so you've got QR codes as you work your way through the book that spring you onto tools that are informed. So we're only allowed, this is what we've decided, only to use 25,000 words for the whole book.
Oh, wow.
And so we're condensing all these arguments down. But how can a business set about creating good growth? And what we're trying to do is translate the text into graphics, imagery that sits alongside a digital platform that you go backwards and forwards in and out of it. And it's completely focused, not for academics, but on owner managers, particularly good. Small, medium-sized enterprise.
You're helping more of the business owner think through how they design and build this into their DNA. If they haven't begun with that forethought, you're helping them think about how it could be a part of their DNA, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And how it becomes exactly part of them, and then going further, allowing the sense of a purpose-led business to flourish through in all that it does. So you design with purpose explicit at the heart of what you do.
Well, Steve, I'm wondering, are there organizations that, I mean, it's too bad. I guess I struggle to think of a regenerative organization, but I have not studied this space like you have. Do you have some
examples of organizations that are either squarely in the space of what you're discussing or, you know, bumping up against that space. I mean, my mind goes to like a B corporation in the United States where it's, you know, a benefit corporation where there's a little more in the DNA than just profiting shareholders. But are there some examples that come to mind for you that you could share with listeners?
Yeah, it's a great point. So Stuart runs his own boutique management development business. And they're a B Corp. So they've just gone through the whole accreditation process. And so that's really interesting that you bring that up. So let me give the example of the UK's largest private dairy.
Okay.
Called Cotswold Dairy. Mm. And they're based, unsurprisingly, in the Cotswold, but they're spelled slightly different to Cotswold. That's a slight distraction. But anyway, Cotswold Dairy. And I've been working with them now off and on through Stuart for about 3-4 years now.
Okay.
And they've been exploring the good dividends. They've tried to turn that into strategy, DNA in a sense. They've become very explicit with their purpose to be at the heart of a regenerative dairy community.
Wow.
Now, it's quite a challenge, actually, a dairy community, because basically they're pumping a whole bunch of methane through their partners, the farmers, and that's a really, really bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the challenge then to turn that whole community regenerative is huge in comparison to perhaps many other sectors. But they've grasped that challenge. Now, here's an interesting thing. I was doing a session with them, and very fortunately, the MD and the chief operating officer were both in this session. And at the break, I could see them just talking about an example I'd given of another company up in the Lancaster area who started partnering with charities rescuing people from modern slavery. It's a big thing globally, but it's equally a big thing in the UK, and it's a big thing in the northwest of England, people being exploited in all sorts of bad ways. Anyway, so I gave the example of this company, a contract cleaning company, quite a large one, 700 employees, and they were struggling to hang on to their employees in the sense it's the first step. You get a cleaning job in order to rescue your CV to move on. So if you were in a bad way, you can get really readily into a cleaning company and move on. So the churn rate, the attrition rate is quite extensive. So I gave that example, and they started working with this charity dealing with modern slavery, who'd rescued people out of modern slavery. And now they were setting up packages of employment opportunities and then other charities connecting to creating homeless charities so they could have homes with people who'd been rescued and now employment opportunities and so on and so forth. So I gave them that example. And about 8 months later, Justin, who's the operations director, contacted me just to ask me some questions because they'd hooked up in a partnership with the local prison. And in the prison, they'd started a scheme where lifers, people who'd been convicted for murder, were getting to the end of their 25, 35 years and going to parole. And part of the process is, can we move them back into society as valued members of society, get over the stigma, create employment opportunities so they basically go into a business for 3 or 4 days a week, but every evening they'd go back to the prison.
Yep.
And so they created a scheme doing that. And what they wanted to talk to me about was, how would we measure that? So instead of being philanthropy, that's a nice thing, we ought to do that. What we want to do is address our attrition rates.
Yes.
What they want to do, they were struggling to get employment. This was 2021, 22. And because we'd gone through Brexit, we no longer had a pool of people available coming into the UK. So now we've got scarcity of labor. So they took that example I gave of modern slavery and thought, can we do something similar? And what they did is set about having a series of measurements around the business. If we measure the level of employee engagement, does that change as a consequence of doing this pro-social, purpose-led activity? Are we seeing, as a consequence of that, any increase in productivity or quality? And how can we measure that? Are we seeing any change in our reputation, particularly internally, how people see us and what we do? So they had a series of measures, and they then got the scheme going with the prison and ran it all the way through for a couple of years, measuring that follow through, and they got to an answer, which was because their attrition levels had fallen back so high, because the level of employee engagement has risen so much, because the sense of purpose now around the work was very, very strong, they were seeing basically a return in the region of 250,000 by not paying agencies for the recruitment of people because their attrition rates had dropped so significantly. And now they're seeing all sorts of other spin-offs around productivity and idea generation and continuous improvement. So they're measuring all those things and it's going through. And they've grown it. They've directly now employed four of the prisoners as employees. And they've now got a partnership with a charity around addiction and homelessness. So they've got two other charities they now work with, all part of a strategic plan to become regenerative in their community. Very exciting case of what they've done by just thinking these ideas through.
Well, and it seems to me that in some ways embedded in how you're challenging these organizations to think is that there's a both and here, that it's not an either or, but there's a both and. This can be doing good and there can be a strategic purpose for this that will benefit the organization, that it's not an either or. Is that accurate? Is in some ways, is that part of the challenge here of really setting the stage for individuals to think in that way?
Yes, it's we've normally referred to it as a win-win.
Yes, yeah.
Everybody's winning. So, for example, by taking those prisoners into employment or at least setting them up for employable jobs if they don't come in directly into Cotswold Dairy, then UK doesn't have to pay all the social service costs for people who are unemployed, who need housing allowances, because we've moved them into employability.
Yes.
So actually our society benefits. Clearly the prisoner benefits if they're going somewhere where there's good work. And what they were looking at was the feeling that culture had changed inside Cotswold as a place that really is pursuing a regenerative community. Mm. It is doing these things in ways that hadn't been considered. So it is a win-win. But they were doing it strategically. It was how they wanted to do business.
Yes.
Here's the interesting thing, though, because this is a leadership podcast, and we're talking maybe about business modeling strategy. For Justin to do this, to take the lead, to wish to pursue these relatively unorthodox approaches, is quite a significant aspect. For him to have the confidence to pursue that, to persuade the board, to persuade the employees. You imagine you are working alongside someone who's been convicted for murder, who's now in your team. Those are massive issues for leadership to consider. Now, if we extrapolate that out, this becomes an enormous leadership challenge that is so significant for the next 50, 100 years. How can those who are in disproportionate influence positions, those leading, who have resource, who have power, to make these things different, can we learn how the Justins of this world have set about pursuing this pro-social, purpose-led approach in their organizations where suddenly, not suddenly, over the space of 18 months or so, Cotswold Dairy are now a beacon for organizations who are now talking to them, all sorts of organizations are talking to them, about how could we adopt some of these approaches and policies? Mm. But it's right at the heart of leadership. Not about people's character and behaviors, but about their intentions, about what they think is important, and how do we set about pursuing these things that deeply matter? Because I'm hoping you're going to ask me about good growth.
Yeah, please. Let's go there.
You sure?
Yeah, please. Let's do it.
So I was just doing a little bit of background work before. This is how I've taken it so seriously, Scott, compared to the last time. Did a little bit of prep. I've got a piece of paper next to me here. So here's a little interesting stat. So the Bank of England did this nice little report. And for living standards to double up to 1750, it took 3,000 years.
Hmm.
Since 1750, living standards have doubled roughly every 50 years.
Wow.
Then you coincide that with, well, what was going on? Well, there was innovation. There was capital becoming freed up. We had the birth, basically, of capitalism on a big scale on steroids all over the place that flourished from mid-1700s to what we see as normal now.
Yes.
So if you look at growth in terms of living standards, it's been staggering. If you look at people's increase in their lives in terms of we now would expect, I hope to get into my 90s. You're much younger. You might expect to get in your hundreds. If I can ask, Scott, how old are your children?
My children are twin girls that are 13 and our son's 15.
And we would expect, as part of our lives, for them, in their generation, to go on 100, 110 maybe.
Oh, yeah.
And there may be some other breakthroughs that moves that, but we don't know about it now.
Yep.
Now, that has come about through growth, through increasing living standards, through what's described as GDP, gross domestic product, the amount of money flowing through, increasing per person, per capita. So on the one hand, these incredible things that enhance life are going along through growth, which is a good thing. On the other hand, it's a wonderfully paradoxical situation here. It's a dreadful thing because of climate change. And climate change, you've probably had much more thoughtful people than me on your podcast. I'm just trying to think.
We have not had a lot of climate change conversations.
Have you not?
No.
Okay, so let me just throw some stats which we might be familiar with. Apparently, about 800 million people would be affected if the sea level rose by half a meter. Okay, so that means New York and Miami.
Yep.
For you, Shanghai, whole stack of other cities around the world, Dakar and around, many, many, many. Now, there was a report out around October, got very, very little traction in the news, certainly is not still being spoken about, that the West Antarctic ice sheet is melting. It's melting rapidly. In fact, it's melting at such a speed now that whatever we do, we can't stop it. If that West Arctic sheet melts its way, which is what this report was saying back in October, that's about a 5 meter rise in sea level.
Wow.
Now, we're now talking billions of people who are now affected. So now we think about your children who may well live to 110, but in their lifetimes, probably most of that ice has melted. Mm. And so the economies now are trying to wrestle with multi-trillion retrenchment, managed retreat of most of the major cities of our world, which are around the coastline, inland. You then say, well, that's one terrible thing. But at the same time, water scarcity through increased temperature is very, very bad. We've then got crop failures. We've got ocean acidification. There was a great talk at the conference that Jonathan Goslin did that we're basically on the cusp of carbon dioxide killing the food chain inside our oceans. Mm. That's going to have disproportionate impact. Now, this is deeply depressing stuff.
Well, not to mention the, you know, climate migration. So you're going to have people moving from one place to another and encroaching, quote unquote, on these people who've been there for years. And now a whole ton of people have moved. And just kind of the stress that that causes, I mean, it's very concerning. Very concerning.
Yeah, we've currently got around 60, 65 million people displaced because of all these changes going on. So climate change produces conflicts between nations.
And the only thing that we can kind of equate that to right now is, let's say Syria has a civil war and all of these Syrians are going all over the world. Well, think of how for some countries, that was a major shift to have an influx of individuals from Syria now in their country. Let's just take any of the Northern European countries. That's the type of shifts we're talking about, where you have now 3 million people moving to other areas and the stress that puts on either that country or that community that we weren't planning for.
We're worried about it now, Scott, and you imagine it increasing fivefold, tenfold over the next 100 years or so. Imagine what your children, and particularly their children, are then trying to do. But equally imagine the conversation that your children or their children are saying, what did that generation at the beginning of the 21st century do? Wasn't our dad involved with a really leading podcast on leadership? And weren't they the great thinkers? And what was the debate? What was the conversation about leadership making a difference? And how can we make a difference?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's not the missing conversation. I mean, it's going on, I'm sure, in many places, but it's not going on with enough traction. It's not going off with enough seriousness. It's not salient enough to make people have this everyday conversation in their bars.
Yeah.
That this is going to be staggeringly bad. And the work that Dennis is done. Dennis Turish. And you can see it in these great leaders. I'm avoiding being political here, but the sense that these pressures almost inevitably produce extreme reactions. And so we end up voting in people who've got very clear answers to these massive problems. And there aren't any clear answers, frankly.
No.
So I'm avoiding being political, but I'm skipping around that. So then, just take my thesis here. On the one hand, growth through increasing living standards has been a really good thing in increasing people's lives, particularly in the developed world, the Western world, so to speak. But at the same time, that has created effectively climate change since the Industrial Revolution. So how do we find a way through this? Do we go for degrowth? Do we ask the developed countries, the Western countries, to reduce their living standards? And in democracies, which most of them are, who is going to put forward that argument that the living standards will fall back by 10, 20% over the next 10, 15 years and get elected and have power?
No.
It's highly unlikely.
Yes.
And at the same time, the view against that argument will be just have even more fuel through ever-increasing numbers of refugees moving around the planet, where we therefore need to build bigger and bigger walls or whatever. We're in the UK wishing to fly people to Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that Africa is going to be hit really badly with climate change. So what we're going to do as our policies, fly them back to Rwanda in Africa as our solution to people coming across the channel. And that's just going to get worse and worse. So you're going to have these polarized, extreme, you've got degrowth. I just don't think we'll ever have traction. So therefore, what is the way through this? And so what we're trying to articulate, a group of us, is this idea of good growth. So we've gone through the word good.
Yep.
We've gone through those ideas of the dividends by investing in and partnering with charities, other organizations in your neighborhood, addressing the environment or addressing social issues. And if we could imagine that business as normal was exploring those things, just as Cotswold Dairy were doing, if that was the normal business perspective, then we would see this multiplier effect, not just what businesses were doing, but it would create an activism that would influence government policy. So then you could imagine government policies are enabling and encouraging even more good growth to occur with taxation systems, penalties, allowances, levies, that you begin to see a complementary sense of the activism and the work that the business is doing, creating enormous pressure on governments to change the way they see the nature of growth. So instead of growth being GDP, growth becomes increasing in living standards and lowering these ecological concerns. That would be a sense of good growth.
I had a conversation back in January with Barbara Kellerman. We were dancing around similar conversations. And, you know, one of her statements was, you know, the only savior right now is technology. Maybe some type of technology will save us from some of these kind of metrics that are not moving in the right direction. And again, whole parts of Antarctica, the size of Manhattan, sloughing off. Check me if I am not saying this correctly, but what I really enjoy about how you are thinking about this is, in some ways it's, and again, I could say this is a both and or this is a win-win, but you're using capitalism against itself. You're showing that this good growth can be incredibly profitable and do good in the world and potentially even not just make it sustainable, but regenerative. Am I tracking with you, Steve?
You are tracking, but there could be many people listening in who would say that's deeply simplistic, naive.
Okay.
And therefore, what we require as researchers, you and I are, is evidence-based.
Yeah.
So instead of just anecdotal, the Cotswold Dairy, and I tell the story, and of course I would tell a good story. Where is the evidence base? How is this all coming together? How can we see the difference from this leadership that's being pursued, regenerative leadership or place-based leadership or whatever name people want to give to it? And so we need to do good work. In my judgment, the leadership industry, at least a bit of it, to roll up its sleeves and say, how can we build a database, build an evidence base to enable leaders to see this as business as normal rather than exceptional and strange? And that, I think, is the work that's got to be done over the next, in my judgment, in the next 10, 15 years or so. Brad Jackson, and you've had Brad on a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
He's doing some great work with a group of people down in North Island, New Zealand, around managed retreat. And that, so managed retreat, you take those coastal cities, towns, villages, and how do we think about moving them to other places? As you think about the movement, what you're deeply getting into is community leadership. You're looking at a very different model of power, of engagement, of different community leaders, different government leaders, local government leaders, businesses coming together in a sort of distributed, shared, community-orientated approach to think through and enact managed retreat. And I think some of the ideas from that will spill over to address many of these other problems that we're talking about. So there is seeds of great work that is going on all over the place, actually.
Is there a multinational organization that you have on your radar that, again, is flirting with some of what you're writing about? Does anyone come to mind right now?
I would say the nearest, there's the World Economic Forum. They're a meeting in Davos literally now. Sadly, they're not having this conversation. Probably, you know, they've all flown in with their private jets and all that issue going on. I hope some of this conversation is going on about what would good growth be? No longer GDP, but when we talk about increasing living standards, lowering ecological concerns, how do we make that happen? And at the same time, grow our businesses in the way that we've been talking about. How do we really do that? And what is the role of government in making that happen? Maybe they're having that conversation. But I think that the group that will have the most immediate impact is Be For Good Leaders. Have you heard of Be For Good Leaders?
No.
So benefit corporations, the B Corps, the group that managed the setup of that, B Lab, particularly B Lab Europe, they formed Be For Good Leaders.
Okay.
Meaning benefit corporation for good leadership.
Yep.
And they started their annual conference 2 years ago, and I think they had just over 1,000. They had over 2,500, I think, last year, and they're expecting even more at their conference coming up in May, June. Now, these are benefit corporations and many other people connected to that who are looking for ways that business can do the sort of things that we've been saying now. And these are all leaders. These are leaders gathering together to make it happen.
You need to be their keynote. Do you want me to call someone to get you set up to keynote that conference there, Steve?
Well, you're very generous. A colleague of mine who set up the Regenerative Alliance, and I'm probably speaking slightly out of turn, but the Regenerative Alliance is very closely partnered with Be For Good Leaders.
Good.
And in the Be For Good Leaders conference, there's a tool that Randall, who set up Regenerative Alliance, and I have created called the Leadership Mirror, asks a series of questions of people based on the conversation we've had this afternoon or this morning or this evening, wherever you are. So in a sense, I am there, but I'm there two or three removed from being there. But Randall's there, and Randall is key. He's wonderful. Great guy.
Well, what I really enjoy about this conversation, and in some ways the practical wisdom for me, is, you know, the challenge at times of academia is that we are thrust into this system, you know, the British Academy of Management or Academy of Management, or that the whole game is, you know, writing in these specific journals, and then you have security. And so that becomes your world, is these head down in these journals. And hopefully your writing is doing some good in the world, but generally speaking, you're just trying to stay safe. And your work is moving into, obviously you have published in all of the best journals in the world, and you are now kind of really, really focused on how does this work and how does our work actually make a difference and actually move the needle and help the world be a better place. And I have great respect for that. I really, really do, because there's this wealth of knowledge about leadership that you bring to the conversation. And then criticism at times is that, you know, we're navel gazing and just focused inward, and we're not necessarily making a difference. And it sounds like on the front lines of trying to do that work.
Well, very kind, very generous comments. It's a slightly different twist. Have you got a pair of jeans on?
I do not. I do not have jeans on. I have sweatpants. I just got done with a walk before we talked.
Yeah. Well, because I was doing my homework yesterday.
This is changing. Are you wearing jeans?
Well, here's the thing. Strangely enough, I am wearing jeans.
Okay.
Because I came across this stat yesterday. Yeah. I just want to make sure I got it into the podcast, if that's all right with you. To make a pair of jeans, consumes 10 years consumption of one person's water. So the water you would consume over 10 years is the amount of water to make one pair of jeans.
Wow.
So when you've got jeans, look after them really carefully.
Wow.
Actually, you've got very good jeans and your children have the benefit of that. So,
well, I meant what I said. I mean, I think you're tackling some of the really big challenges, and I love your phrase of leadership for what, and you are continuing in some ways to help us define leadership for what. And, you know, I love how you're thinking, because in some ways back in January, I had some episodes that were really kind of exploring the context and what's swirling around us right now. And you're thinking in ways of, okay, how do we planfully move and shift out of kind of that old mindset into a new mindset of what leadership's purpose is, of what organization's purpose is. And I think that's really valuable.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So I always close out these conversations by asking what you've been listening to, reading, streaming. Could have something to do with what we've just discussed. It could have nothing to do with what we've just discussed. I know you're a lover of music and a voracious reader. So what's caught your attention in recent times? What do you think?
Well, I remember you asked me this question way back in 2020. And I thought, why am I not listening to podcasts? When you said, tell us about your favorite podcast. And so I tend to listen to podcasts on politics. And so there's a nice one in the UK called And the Rest is Politics.
Okay.
And it's really, really good. So if you get a chance to look at it, listen to it, you might just get into a bit of it's UK politics. Ever since my history teacher, she took us to the Houses of Parliament when I was 18. And we were up in the gallery, visitors gallery, it's called.
Yeah.
And you've got this is in the House of Commons. And they took a vote of no confidence when we were there. And the Labour government lost the vote of confidence and there had to be an election. And from that day onwards, I was captivated by politics.
Wow.
The complexity, the intrigue, the way they communicate, so many dimensions of politics I find fascinating. And for the whole conversation that we've had, it is so important.
Oh, yeah.
That politics, politicians get it. And even more, Scott, I would say, that we as consumers of this stuff that we've been talking about become more sophisticated so we can allow our politicians some space to explore and express and think these things through instead of glib, short answers, because it's a super complex thing that yes. We've been talking about. And we, as consumers of this stuff, need to become really, really thoughtful and engaged to help them to come up with the right ways of moving this agenda forward. So that's podcast. And YouTube, I can't remember if I mentioned this, but I'm still following The Daily Doug. Do you follow The Daily Doug?
No.
Daily Doug is an American guy. I don't know which part he's in. You would know it as soon as you hear his accent. Okay. He's a classical composer, and he basically examines music, and he's got a keyboard right next to him, and he's brilliant. He'll listen to something, and he'll say, I think that's in G minor, and then he'll play it as they're playing it. Oh, I see what they're doing. And they're moving here and there, and then he goes back and listens to it, makes sense. But he also is a scholar. And he wants to know everything about how the music was constructed, what the lyrics mean. And so it's multi-layered. So I listen to The Daily Doug, and it's really engaging, very entertaining. And he does talk about a lot of music that you and I both like. So
every day he has another.
Yeah, every day. Friday is the best day because that's when he tackles the big pieces of music. So you have a good big session where he might tackle Genesis, Supper's Ready or something like that.
Okay.
And he gets right into it, yeah. So that I enjoy a lot. What do you listen to? What's your podcast favorite?
Oof, my podcast favorite. You know, I've been so immersed in audiobooks. And so I think I have probably 6 audiobooks in the queue. You know, this question that I ask at the end of the podcast has taken me on so many different adventures. And so in recent times, I've listened to books on digitization. And there's one called The Coming Wave, which is by one of the co-founders of DeepMind, which was developed in the UK. It's all about artificial intelligence. You and I have been talking about that topic for a long time, probably 2017 or 2018 at the ILA conferences. We were doing sessions on that topic. And then also back to your point of there is so much knowledge in political science that I don't think has translated over to leadership, which is tragic. So I listened to two books. Dennis Tourish, who you'd mentioned, offered up the book, How Civil Wars Start, which was a political science professor from the University of California, San Diego. And Sin Cherry had mentioned a book, How Democracies Die. And there are some behaviors, at least in the context of the United States, and I know around the world, there are some behaviors and there's some norms that are being shattered and that are not, in my mind, sustainable. And so I'm wondering what's going on, what's swirling around us, what's happening that is causing some of this, you know, the political divide, and we're coming into an election year. So these political scientists are putting names to things that I didn't have the language for. So for instance, if you have a population, so let's go Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. And if you have Protestants come in, and in some ways downgrade a population of people, their lived experience, and this could be anywhere in the world throughout world history. If you have a population that is being downgraded or has been downgraded, either systematically or has been downgraded just because of demographics. So one of these political scientists, she talks about the U.S. becoming the first multi-ethnic democracy. Based on our population statistics, the number of whites are decreasing. And I think it's by 2040, they will be the minority in the United States. Well, how does a country where essentially the people who founded the country, white men, quote unquote, I mean, not quote unquote, but that's the fact, are in some ways shifting authority to others, whether that's women, whether that's people of different ethnicities. And can we make that shift in a peaceful way? Because in some senses, those white males and their authority is being downgraded. So that's the terminology that they use. There's less power, less influence among this faction of people that has always had power or influence. Mm-hmm. So Sunnis and Shias in Iraq. I mean, there was a flip-flop there. We could go to Yugoslavia. We could go to any number of other places around the world. And when a faction of people has been downgraded, they protest. And if they don't get their ways through protest, oftentimes it turns to violence. And so these political scientists, I mean, I'm listening to these two books, Steve, and they just term after term after term is putting words and language to things that I'm experiencing that are really, really, really important. So to your point, looking at some sociology, and that's part of the challenge of what we do, is that you can look at leadership through the lens of sociology or biology or political science or history or philosophy. So it's hard to learn everything, but there's just these incredible pieces of knowledge in political science that, I mean, I want a degree. I want a degree in political science now because...
Me too. I'd love to spend some time and do a deep dive in that. Yeah,
because I mean, you know, it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. In biology, a species will, you know, fight to maintain its resources. It's just biology. And so we as humans, can we make some of these transitions, some of them that you were speaking of, some of these climate change shifts that will occur, are those transitions going to be done in a way where we navigate them with, use a word, intentionality, there's some design, and there's some thoughtfulness, or will we descend into some pretty dark places because of some of the other things that you had mentioned? And it's worrisome. And so I'm curious about that. I don't want to sound alarmist to listeners, but some of the indicators are alarming. And are we eyes wide open and paying close attention and trying to make sense of some of those rapid shifts that are going to destabilize us?
That's right. I'm leaning down here and I'm looking for a book that was recommended that picks up a theme there. It's called Radical Hope.
Okay.
It was recommended and it's wonderful. It's about an American Indian tribe and them becoming moved and settled and losing their sense of identity, but running through it in the hope is this radical hope. And the wonderful thing about the book, Scott, is The title's Radical Hope, but it never says Radical Hope. There's never a mention. There's never exploration of Radical Hope. It's just the narrative of what occurs. And you feel it. You sense it written through the whole without it ever being expressed. Yeah. Things have got to get worse before they get better, but we have to have hope.
Yes, I agree. It's such an interesting time in history because you have so many wonderful things that are happening. You know, infant mortality rates are lower. There's a greater number of democracies to some of the statistics you mentioned in our episode. And so there's a lot of good. The number of wars, obviously, there's a couple that are big in our minds right now. But generally speaking, there's not a world war. There's not large scale. It's one of the safest times in history to live. And there's these shifts that are occurring and shifts on a number of fronts. And they're fairly seismic, whether it's geopolitical, an influence on the global stage between the United States and China. There's shifts happening there, or there's shifts in, like I said, you know, multi-ethnic governance in a country that maybe didn't have that. And how do we navigate those shifts well? So again, going back to your work, I have great respect for it because you are trying to help people think intentionally. And again, the word for me is design, some of these win-wins, and exist in a way that helps us move the needle and make the world a better place. And still, to your point, do well as an organization and as a company. And I have great respect. As always, sir, I love our conversations. I really do.
Well, thank you for the time. Thank you for inviting me again. It's a deep honor. I'm very grateful. So go well, Scott.
Yes.
And stay warm. I think it's very cold with you, isn't it?
It is cold. It's very cold. I hope to see you in Birmingham next December.
Absolutely, next December. Look forward to that. It'll be great that you're coming over.
Yes, International Studying Leadership Conference. I'll be back. I had so much fun. It's great, great experience.
It was.
Okay, sir, be well.
Go well.
Bye-bye. I always, as I said in the episode, Steve always challenges my thinking and takes it to new places. I remember in a pub a few years back, he said, "Yes, Scott, but leadership for what?" And it just, he gets my mind cooking because I'd never thought about that, as odd as that might sound. But he is taking our thinking to new places and answering that question, leadership for what? If you enjoyed this episode, there is an upcoming episode with Kathy Allen and Ryan Satterwhite, where we also continue down some of this dialogue in conjunction with Earth Day. Number of shifts, geopolitical, demographic. We have shifts around digitization, globalization. We have wars that are occurring in the world right now in ways that we hadn't had in recent years. And these shifts cause instability and they require leadership. And what I love about Steve's work, for me, the practical wisdom is leadership for what? What are we working toward? And are we, as academics and individuals interested in the scholarship of leadership, actively working to be part of the solution as well to help make that transition? And Steve said that beautifully, absolutely beautifully in that episode. So I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I hope you found it intriguing, and I hope you do something about it. Take care, everyone. Be well. As always, thank you so much for listening.
You have just finished another episode of Practical Wisdom for Leaders with Scott Allen. To contact me, visit www.scottjallen.net or send me a note at scott@scottjallen.net. I can also be found on Twitter and LinkedIn, so let's connect. Now, if you have feedback, I'd love to hear it. And as always, thank you so much for listening. One final nod to our sponsors, the International Leadership Association and the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. And now, here's Kate's twin sister, Emily, with the outro.
You've been listening to Phronesis, Practical Wisdom with Scott Allen.